there are many recent examples of personal attacks in the political arena, including one this week where Democratic State Senator Tim Carpenter said that his Republican colleague, State Senator Mary Lozick, hated Milwaukee, hated poll workers, hated that blacks and Latinos were coming out to vote in Milwaukee. This was during a heated floor debate over a bill that would have restricted early in-person absentee voting hours in Wisconsin, including in Milwaukee. Well, Senator Lozick objected on the floor, and the GOP is demanding an apology, and so far there has not been one. We are going to talk about not just this example, but the issue of personal attacks in politics in general and the state of our public discourse today. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, March 13th. So do you think it was inappropriate for Senator Carpenter to say what he said? Was it okay for a Democratic state senator to call Governor Walker's State of the State address a piece of profanity? How about rock star Ted Nugent calling the president a mongrel? How about all the name-calling that you can read on just about any Facebook page or newspaper story comment area? Why do we attack people and not issues? And how can we improve our public political discourse? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Communication and in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's part of a group that is researching personal attacks in politics. Well, before I ask you about this Wisconsin example, Professor Wagner, tell us a little bit more about what your research is about.
Well, the contentious politics group at the University of Wisconsin is starting to get really interested in kind of the causes and consequences of incredibly uncivil political debate. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, we use the Wisconsin recall as our first kind of case study. And so we rely on a bunch of surveys that were done from the University of Marquette's law poll that were done over the course of the recall. And we tap people's attitudes about Governor Walker, Mayor Barrett, their own partisan attitudes, their own issue attitudes, but also their behaviors in their regular life. And what we found was that people who were on opposite sides of the recall debate often would stop talking to people in their regular life friendship networks. And so this wasn't just I cast my private vote and I like the governor or I don't like the governor or I like Mayor Barrett or I don't. This was a situation where people would kind of fundamentally alter the way they live their lives by stopping talking to people who were regular parts of their friendship networks. And one member of our group, Kathy Kramer, who's a professor in political science, has spent her career going to different communities in Wisconsin and finding groups that talk politics, and she found the same thing on the ground. She would go into a coffee shop where people gather to talk about, you know, life and politics, and she would say, oh, well, where's Gary? Oh, he stopped coming because he's on the other side of the recall than we are. And so this kind of pervasive influence of contentious politics does more than just affect our politics. It affects our day-to-day life. And so we're interested in trying to figure out why this happens and is there anything that regular people, politicians, the news media can do about it.
Yeah, well, why does this happen?
Well, one reason is, you know, just quite fundamentally, politics in the United States is a zero-sum game. And so if you get 50% plus one of the vote, you win, which encourages contentious politics. And in some other democracies, if your party gets 10% of the vote on election day, you get 10% of the seats in your legislature. But that's not how it works here. And so there's a real cachet to winning. And when winning means getting one more vote than the other person and then getting all of the power, there's a reason to be contentious and fight tooth and nail to get those last votes. And so contentious politics isn't really something that's new in the United States. If you were to look back and see the things that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and their surrogates said about each other, running to replace George Washington, it would make most people blanch even today. And so we've had very aggressive contentious politics since we've had a republic. And one of the reasons is just we have a winner-take-all system.
Yeah, well, and certainly it's been around for a while. And as you mentioned in your research with the contentious politics during the recall, some people stopped talking to each other. On the other hand, some people started calling each other names, too. I mean, that probably happened in the past, too. But, for example, I'm not trying to put the spotlight on me, but I was called a really nasty name on my Facebook page, on the show's Facebook page, because someone thought my politics mm-hmm. were different than their politics.
Yeah, when people really care about a political issue, which, you know, isn't typical, right? Most people don't wake up and think, how am I going to hold my government accountable today? That's just not most people's life story. But when people really care about an issue, it's wrapped up in their identity and how they see themselves. And when that is under attack, their identity is under attack. And quite naturally, when your identity is under attack, you do whatever you can to protect it. And sometimes that involves saying things that aren't so nice and behaving in ways that you might not behave if you were thinking about a spotlight being on you and having others be aware of the kinds of things you were doing. And so, you know, a lot of times when it's these really salient issues like a race for governor after a major landmark piece of legislation was passed, like Act 10, where people, you know, had very strong opinions about whether they liked it or didn't like it. Those kinds of things get wrapped up in other identities, like your union membership or your rural identity or your city identity or your identity as a teacher. And so all of a sudden, things that aren't overtly political have become a part of politics. And when that happens, the nastiness is usually the thing that follows.
You know, let's take a listen to Senator Tim Carpenter from the debate on the state Senate floor earlier this week. It was first reported that he said his GOP colleague hated blacks and Latinos. But if you listen a little bit carefully here, he doesn't say exactly that.
I know the senator from the 28th hates Milwaukee. She hates the poll workers. She hates that blacks and Latinos are coming out.
So he didn't say she hates blacks, she hates Latinos. He said she hates that blacks and Latinos are coming out. And he explained later he meant he would have said, had he not been interrupted, hates that they are coming out to vote for Democrats. So just your assessment of that particular statement.
Well, I think the full record is a little better, but not a lot better. I mean, he still was saying, you know, that his colleague hated, you know, a city of people, hates people who volunteer their time to work on election day, and hates that particular groups, non-white groups in this case, show up to vote for Democrats on election day. And while it's empirically true that blacks and Latinos are overwhelmingly likely to support Democrats, the hate that they do that, comment is the kind of thing that most people see and shake their head and say, well, that's why I don't like politics, is statements like that.
Yeah, so he's been asked to apologize, or the GOP demanded an apology, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in an editorial says that it would be a good step toward more civility if he would apologize. What do you say?
Well, you know, usually, when I do something when I say something I regret, I try to apologize and apologize quickly and without a caveat, you know, and usually when something like this happens, the apology is, I apologize if anyone was offended. Well, the reason you're apologizing is that someone was offended. And so it's better, I think, just to say, I said this, I was wrong. Here's, you know, and if you want to go on and say, here's my policy difference with the person I was disagreeing with, that's fine. But at some point, you know, when people behave in a way that's, less than civil, an apology is probably a nice way to move forward.
You are researching the consequences of contentious politics. So what are the consequences of, for example, what Senator Carpenter said right there?
One of the consequences from the point of view of how laws get made is that it becomes much more difficult to compromise in an environment that's really full of vilification. So what I mean by that is, you know, you could disagree about a public policy. You could say, voter ID laws disproportionately affect these particular groups, and there's not a good reason to tamp down these particular groups showing up on Election Day. And the benefit is non-existent because voter fraud is not a rampant problem. So you can make a policy argument, or you could say, you know, you could be uncivil and say, you know, these jerks just want to, you know, keep winning elections, you know, do some name calling. Or you could vilify and say you hate the other side, you're a threat to the American way of life, and you must be stopped at all costs. And what we found in our research is that when this vilifying rhetoric takes place, lawmakers are less likely to compromise with each other. So you call me a name, I get over it if we can come to some kind of agreement to pass a policy. But you call me a threat to our way of life and impugn my identity and my integrity, now it's much more difficult to compromise. And it's much more difficult for the person doing the name calling, right? So if I say, you know, Joy, you are a terrible person and your show is a threat to the way your American way of life, and then I appear on your show, now I'm showing all of my supporters that I compromise with the enemy. And now I can't be trusted because... which is it? Are you terrible or are you worth being compromised with? And so this kind of vilifying rhetoric makes compromise, which is the essential ingredient of democracy, less likely.
Did you comment on my Facebook page this week, by any chance? I'm just
kidding. That wasn't me.
We will. We'll talk. Actually, I'm going to talk a little bit about this particular post, only in that it brings up the issue of so-called trolls. And I want to see if you have any comment on that. As we are talking about contentious politics, personal attacks in politics, and our public discourse, the causes and the consequences. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, maybe you have a solution. What would you do to better our political or public discourse? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison, who is part of a group that is researching contentious politics. And that's what we're talking about, contentious politics, personal attacks in politics, and our public discourse. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions about this. Our conversation is prompted by a number of examples of personal attacks in politics recently, including on the Senate floor this week, Democratic State Senator Tim Carpenter saying that one of his GOP colleagues hates Milwaukee, hates poll workers, and hates that blacks and Latinos come out to vote for Democrats. So should he apologize, as some are calling on him to do? And what do you think about the state of political discourse in this state, in this country? We have, before I go to the calls, I did want to talk a little bit about the comments that you'll see on Facebook pages or underneath, you know, in the comments sections under a news story. And I had mentioned I was called a nasty name on our Facebook page, but it's all over the place. And now, I mean, newspapers are refining their policies. They're cutting off the comments sections. And some people are saying, why has that gotten so nasty? And is it because of so-called trolls?
Well, one reason is that a lot of these comments are anonymous. And so when no one's watching, sometimes people behave in ways that, you know, aren't their best selves. And so when you can anonymously post on a Facebook page or especially on an online news site where you can just, you know, invent a fake name and then put in your comments, there's not a lot of consequences for you for doing that. Some folks at Wisconsin in the life science communication department here have done research that shows that those kinds of comments have really negative influences on whether people are willing to believe, you know, the facts that are reported in the journalism that precedes those comments. And so that kind of work has prompted some news organizations to shut down their comments page. And so on the one hand, you know, you could say this is anti-democratic. It's taking a voice away from readers or viewers or people who go online. On the other hand, it's also seeking to limit the power of anonymous trolls who, you know, aren't fact-checked, pay no consequence if they behave badly, and are people whose behavior can sometimes influence whether people are willing to believe the truth that we might find in the news reporting.
Well, we have many more questions for you, but we have many callers, too. So let's go to Jean in Eau Claire. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been watching what's been going on in our in the Senate and in the Assembly through WSI Live. And on that particular day, and it's happened a lot, when our senators and congressmen have been fighting to prevent some significant impacts to the public in general before they're even aware of it, I have noted that Republicans stand and smile. And on this particular day, this senator, who represents Milwaukee, by the way, was speaking and, you know, and fighting for his right to speak for the people he was representing. I heard loud and clear, he's just being a pain in the ass. Now, the Republicans are not calling for themselves to apologize, and I think that that senator was justified.
Well, I'm not positive if that particular word was a part of the debate or not, but that's what Jean heard. Your thoughts on that, Professor Wagner?
Well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a senator in our state or others or the U.S. Congress have said untoward things about someone else while they were talking. Heck, somebody yelled at the president during the State of the Union a few years ago. And so these sorts of things happen, that's for sure. And I think, you know, all anybody in their lives can control really is what they do and how they react when something happens. And, you know, it would certainly make my blood boil if I was speaking and representing my constituents and someone called me a pain in the rump. I would hope that I wouldn't respond by calling them names, too. But, you know, in the heat of the moment, it's hard to predict how people will respond.
Heat of the moment or not, what if, I'm not saying it is, but what if the name is true? You know, what if the name that is being issued, you know, the name calling is true?
Right. That's, you know, often in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. And so people tend to engage in what, you know, psychologists call motivated reasoning, which is to say people like to work really hard to make arguments to keep believing what they already believed, even in the face of evidence that they might be wrong. And so because it's just difficult to admit that you're wrong. It's difficult to want to change your mind when presented with new kinds of evidence. And sometimes, you know, this kind of rhetoric might be accurate. I think where we need to be careful is when the claim is a mind-reading claim. So to say you hate Milwaukee or you hate poll workers, it's pretty difficult to know whether someone really hates them. You could say your laws have these deleterious effects on poll workers, or these, or they affect my constituents in this way, and that makes me wonder why you would want to do this. But to say you hate, or to read someone else's mind, I think is a dangerous idea.
Let's go next to Ray in Merrill. Hello, Ray.
Hi. Good morning. You know, like the word hate, that's pretty mild to some of the stuff that I've been hearing, you know, like the subhuman mongrel, and
right,
the Hitler and the Nazi stuff. And,
right.
You know, but my question was, you know, this is what we see in our leaders and in our media and all this. And would we be so willing to accept this behavior from our kids if they behave that way towards us or towards their teachers in school or towards each other for that matter? And if we wouldn't, then what does that say about us as adults, that we're hypocrites? You know, I use the example of the kids. I wouldn't stand for my kids to talk that way to somebody else, an adult or anybody like that. So why do we accept it out of our leaders, our media, whatever the case might be?
Yeah, thanks, Ray. Well, do you have a thought on why we accept this, or do we?
Well, I think that's a good question. You know, people, we don't have the level of control over our lawmakers that we have over our kids. We get a vote, but you know, any one person's vote isn't likely to change the results of an election. But when my 5-year-old does something in public that I don't want her to do, I can stop her. I can remove her from the toy store if I want to. And so I can't do that with the state senator. And so our level of control is a little different. The other difference is, you know, goes back to this idea that the politics is really a zero-sum game in the United States. And so if I don't like that a person in my party says, you know, calls the president a subhuman mongrel or tells, you know, a Republican senator to, you know, go to where you know where on the floor of the Senate or something like that, it's difficult for me to do much about that. And especially because the first alternative is to vote for the person in the other party. But I already disagree with the other party on a whole you know, a whole wide range of issues. And so we're stuck with the folks that we choose in our primary elections to run for office. And so, you know, and also, you know, those people are on our team. We tend to be more forgiving when folks are on our team. When we start watching the Big Ten tournament this week, you know, Frank Kaminsky bumps, you know, the elbow of a shooter, we might say, well, that's incidental contact. But if someone bumps his elbow, well, that's a foul, right? Yeah. And so when our team is involved, we have different kinds of responses, which is a little different than kids because, you know, of course, you know, they're your family, but you're also trying to shape and guide them. And so you protect them when they need protecting and you, you know, discipline them when they need discipline. But you have much more direct control over kids than politicians, even when politicians act like kids.
You know, we have just a minute before news, but I want to get this in before news in that that the subhuman mongrel comment from Ted Nugent. He did back off that a little bit, saying, I need to learn better vocabulary from, you know, from these other politicians. These other Republican politicians would have him at fundraisers and rallies. Mm-hmm. Maybe is... What does that say? That somebody is sought out to speak when they've made so many controversial comments?
Well, you know, it's fair to interpret that as a tacit endorsement of the things that they say. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I don't know that we should make any one person responsible for the behavior of any other adult. But if you're going to start associating yourself with a person who has a pattern of that kind of behavior, then I think it's fair to wonder if that says something about you. And so when folks like Mr. Nugent say that, those kinds of things, and then politicians say, let's bring you in to raise some money for us, it's fair to ask questions about that.
We'll check news and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Are you concerned about civility in public discourse? How would you try to change it for the better? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7:37 on this... What day is it? It's Thursday, March the 13th. We are talking with a professor of journalism and political science at UW-Madison about our political discourse, our public discourse, and personal attacks in politics. Our conversation was prompted by a statement made by Senator Tim Carpenter on the Wisconsin State Senate floor this week, but we're not concentrating exclusively on that. We're talking about why politicians and citizens personally attack a rival or an opponent or someone they disagree with rather than addressing the issue that is the reason for the disagreement. Why do you think that is and what can be done about it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mike Wagner is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's part of a group that is researching personal attacks or contentious politics. And I wanted to talk to you before we go back to the phones, Professor Wagner, about a group of journalists getting together, mm-hmm. saying that, hey, this Pew survey on civility in society shows that, number one, most people think it's a big problem, and number two, most people blame the media for what's going on. Talk some about that first. Is this the media's fault?
Well, people think it is, and whether it is, I think, is, you know, a matter of debate that, you know, sometimes the answer is yes and sometimes the answer is no. But the one reason the media is a punching bag is that politicians love to blame the media. And, you know, you could think back to the 2012 Republican primaries when they had all those debates. And when Newt Gingrich was flying high in the polls, it seemed to follow when he was in a debate and they would ask a question about his personal life and he would respond by attacking the media and the crowd would go wild. And that kind of thing happens a lot in news coverage where politicians attack the media and blame it for being biased. And just individually, people often are kind of fall prey to something called the hostile media effect, which is the idea that when we come across a piece of information on television or in the paper or online, we tend to remember the stuff that's against our point of view and forget the reporting that endorses our point of view. And so then we conclude, oh, this story is hostile to me. It's biased and that kind of thing. And so, you know, the tendency to remember the negative and forget the positive leads us to think that the media are being unfair. And sometimes, indeed, you know, the news media are. One reason the media tend to do so much coverage of this kind of uncivil behavior is that we watch. A lot of interesting research from one of our alums, Diana Mutz, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, shows that when people see uncivil arguments on television or in-your-face politics, they are more physiologically interested. They're just more excited by what they're watching, and they remember it more. They recall negative arguments more than they recall positive ones, which is one reason politicians do negative ads. We all say we hate negative ads. They're full of more information, and we remember them, which is one reason politicians use them. And so part of the problem is that we continue to watch these programs. We continue to not hold politicians' feet to the fire on matters of civility. And maybe that's that makes sense because, you know, if we had to choose between civility and matters of public policy, most people would rather their politicians agree with them on policy rather than process.
The group of journalists got together to try to figure out, is there anything journalists can do to improve our public discourse? And came up with a mission statement, which I won't read in its entirety, but in essence it was seek and report the truth.
Right. And, you know, that should be the first goal of any journalist, right? Mm-hmm. Report the verifiable truth is what journalists are supposed to be doing here. The truth is sometimes a matter of debate, right? Is it true that the Affordable Care Act will cut health care costs or spiral out of control? Well, there's evidence that can, you know, support both of those claims, and we can't yet know what the Affordable Care Act's consequences are. And so how should journalists report the truth in that situation? And so it's a good goal, but it's tough to pin down what the truth is all the time. And journalists sometimes will rely on that to engage in what scholars like me call false equivalence, which is to say giving equal weight to two competing arguments, right? You would never see a story. We were talking about this in the break. Well, you never see a story that said, you know, some scholars say, you know, the Holocaust happened, and other people say, like, you know, former Iranian leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that it was a hoax, right? That no one would report that, even though there were two sides to that issue. One side is in the wrong completely, and the other side has evidence on their side. But political matters usually aren't that cut and dried. And so it's difficult for journalists to figure out, are we reporting the truth, or are we just giving both sides equal weight when we shouldn't? It's just a tough problem.
And we also had a Facebook commenter who said, why don't you get rid of the blowhards on your Week in Review program? Now, that's a program we do here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and he didn't define which ones were the blowhards or if they were all blowhards. But I will say that I think our political commentators are maybe not exclusively, but mostly very civil, and that none of them are blowhards. But you see talking head shows all the time, and,
oh, sure,
and a lot of arguing going on, and screaming at each other,
yep,
and shouting. And is that a part of this?
It's a part of it. One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, it's very visible and it's very enticing and exciting or infuriating, depending upon your point of view. But, you know, if we think about how many people watch network television news every night, so north of, you know, 20, 25 million people, and how many people watch The O'Reilly Factor or The Rachel Maddow Show, you know, combined maybe 6 million people a night. You know, not as many people are watching these programs. They get attention because of their volume and the provocative nature of the things that they say, but the people watching those shows are pretty entrenched partisans. Not a lot of liberals go to Sean Hannity to get the news, and not a lot of conservatives go, you know, to the Ed Show on MSNBC to get their news. And so people are hearing endorsements of their own point of view. On the other hand, that makes people more confident in their point of view. And when they constantly watch information that confirms what they think, they become more confident in their attitudes, less willing to hear the other side, and that makes compromise more difficult.
All right, back to the phones. Karen in Wauwatosa. Hi, Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I want to talk because I think one of the things that changed the dialogue in Wisconsin was publishing a searchable name group for the recall. I think that that spread fear and intimidation and anger with people, and I think that changed our tone a lot in this state. But the other thing is, I do think the guy should apologize for what, you know, he said to the woman, senator, congressman, whatever it was, because I don't think he knows how she feels. However, I do know earlier in the conversation, you said something about, well, what if it's the truth? And so I think it's a balancing act, because if you hang around Ted Nugent, if you want him to come to your events, I think it's reasonable to say that, you have some issues as it relates to Ted Nugent and his thoughts. Or if you verifiably know something about somebody, you should be able to say that. But you don't know what someone thinks.
Yeah. All right. So, and you made that point. It's hard to know what someone is feeling or thinking.
It is, and I think she makes a lot of good points, the caller there. And, one thing that works for politicians, they don't do it often, but one thing that works is what scholars call costly talk, which is to say when you criticize your own. Right, it's cheap talk to say the other side's bananas and they're out of their mind, because you expect Democrats to say Republicans are wrong and Republicans to say Democrats are. But when you are criticizing your own supporters, that carries more weight. And so, kind of the insight of the caller there is to say, if a Republican politician would have Ted Nugent to a fundraiser and say, we're going to welcome the Motor City Madman here, but he's saying things that I don't think he should be saying, and the reason he shouldn't be saying them is that they're destructive to compromise and democracy, that might go a long way. It could also backfire on people who really don't like the president and would blanch at anybody defending the president, even from someone who was calling him names. But usually that kind of costly talk is more effective.
Yeah, I just saw a headline on, I think it was a liberal-leaning blog, where Michelle Bachmann was, the headline included, that she's crazy, stupid, bat profanity. And it was like, really? Can't you just disagree on what she's saying or address the issue rather than calling her, crazy and stupid?
Yeah, we go from zero to screaming pretty quickly, I think, in American politics or actually in politics anywhere. And, we see that a lot where people are frustrated that their policy disagreements might not get the attention they want them to get. And so they think, well, how can I get some attention? By calling someone insane, crazy, mm-hmm. portraying them in a really unflattering light, and name-calling gets more attention than, here are the reasons I think Congresswoman Bachmann is wrong from a policy point of view.
So our caller did bring up that she thought a lot of this was fueled by, or maybe intensified by, the searchable recall mm-hmm. petition databases, because it instilled a lot of fear. Fear is a part of why we might lash out.
Oh, sure. Anxiety and fear are emotions that have something to do with a lot of our behaviors, and a lot of those behaviors have to do with making political choices. And so having your name out there like that might cause fear in some, but it also might just have a consequence on the other side. It might be I can look this up now, look up my neighbors. Oh, gosh, I didn't think Gene would support that. So it just adds another layer of people's awareness of the politics of those around them. And, if we're going to say the governor should be recalled, maybe we ought to be willing to put our name on it in a public way. But to kind of be surprised by, that being revealed and maybe you weren't expecting it to be revealed could certainly have those kinds of negative effects that the caller was pointing to.
We are talking about the causes, the consequences of our political discourse. We're talking about personal attacks in politics, contentious politics, not just between and among politicians, but citizens as well. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your suggestions as to what we can do to better our political discourse. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest journalism and political science professor, Mike Wagner at UW-Madison, who is researching contentious politics. And we're talking about recent examples of contentious politics and welcoming your questions and views for him. Let's try to take as many calls as we can now. Bob in Stevens Point is with us. Hello, Bob.
Regarding the whole subject of the body of the whole, now I'll use Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee as an example. Now, apparently the Senate stayed up all night talking about the Milwaukee vote. I don't want to discuss that. The next day she does it some more. She repeats and repeats. She says the outer ring is absent, and she's always playing to Wisconsin eye. I wish progressives and liberals and any politician would realize that they cannot say, I speak for the people of Wisconsin. She speaks for the people that voted for her.
Well,
let's spend more time in committee.
So, all right. Do you have a reaction to that? I'm not sure. So a politician should not say they're speaking for the people is, I guess, Bob's point.
Well, you know, politicians, that, I mean, that's how they operate. And usually the way they operate is really vague. You know, the American people know, insert my opinion. And, you know, that's obviously frustrating to the caller. And, you know, it makes sense that it's frustrating. It's tough to figure out what they should do in a representative democracy that would be different since we're sending them there to make choices for us. But, you know, I understand the inclination to have to want a politician to say, here's what I think and here's the evidence I have. And, you know, here's why I want to do X, Y, or Z. But we probably shouldn't hold our breath for them to change their behavior.
Let's go to Randy in Madison. You know, actually, before we go to Randy, I know Bob was singling out one particular politician that he noticed doing this. But you said that one of the consequences of this kind of contentious politics is that we don't trust our politicians. We don't trust our government as much.
Trust in government has been dropping fairly precipitously for at least four decades. And one reason for that is our increasing distrust of the news media. And, you know, those two trends have gone hand in hand. And so we're trusting the information we get about our way of life less and less. And we're trusting the people we're asking to make decisions for us, to help govern us in a way, less and less. And so those two things have been working together. You know, a lot of folks say, you know, since Watergate, you know, for a long, long time now.
Yeah, so it has been a long time. It's just going to always be this way, and we should just kind of shrug it off? Or are you, you know, what do you think? Is this something that we should be wringing our hands over?
Well, I think it's always important to ask, how can we do better? You know, I think when you stop asking, how can you get better, you know, you're closer to the end than you are to the beginning of anything, whether it's a powerful political country or your own career. And so, you know, I think it's worth our time to try to think about how can we make this sort of thing better. And you know, the journalists you were talking about before the break are making an effort with that to say, well, let's try to figure out how we can do a better job of reporting the truth and hope that that truth influences people's attitudes. You know, people with jobs like mine can do a better job training journalists to cover the news and also helping students understand their own biases, biases of different media outlets, you know, and how those things work together when people are called to make decisions. And so the more we're aware of those kinds of things, I think the better. But certainly the trend has been in the wrong direction over the last long time.
And citizens can tell other citizens, hey, let's talk about the issues. You don't have to call a politician so-and-so or citizen so-and-so a name.
Yeah, you know, I think that behavior that pushes back against uncivil or vilifying rhetoric is effective. And, you know, you can kind of see a correlate of that in the entertainment world. So in the last few weeks, an actress, Kristen Bell, and her husband, an actor, Dax Shepard, they have a new baby, and they don't want their kid getting their picture taken. They get that their picture is going to get taken because they're stars, and they understand that, but don't take pictures of our kids. And so they've started to boycott magazines that take pictures of kids and put them in their magazine. And big magazines like People magazine have stopped that behavior. And so by boycotting and having other big stars do the same, it changed a news outlet's behavior. And so by refusing to endorse this kind of behavior in politics, we, you know, might be able to see a correlate or, you know, a similar sort of influence. You know, and it's part of it is with our own eyeballs. If we don't like some, you know, a media host yelling every night, then we should stop watching it. You know, and we should find a source that's trying to provide more serious, fair-minded, evidence-based coverage.
All right, now I'll get Randy and Madison on. Hi, Randy.
Hi, great show, and sure, wonderful to hear a guest who knows that the word media is plural.
I do too. Go ahead.
Two quick points. Back when I was a college firebrand, One of the people I consider my mentor told me that people are more important than ideas. And I've repeated that sometimes, and I found there's a surprising number of people who feel just the reverse. That I think might be one of the underlying causes. I think also politics tends to have a disproportionate attraction to people who already have baggage, have trouble getting along with people. I know shows like this often get calls, like during election years, from people who brag about the fights they get into at work over politics. Those are just two ideas I wanted to bounce off.
All right. People are more important than ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, that speaks to the larger issue of fundamental differences in how people approach their lives. And so for some people, the idea is what matters, and whatever I've got to do to make that idea happen is what I'm going to do. For others, interpersonal relationship is important. And those two kinds of people often talk past each other because one cares about ideas and one cares about people. And we see that same fundamental process happening in politics, people talking past each other because of some, way that they see themselves, a part of their identity, a part of their political affiliation, a part of their, community, and they talk past each other, which leads us to seeing the same kinds of problems over and over again. And I think that that's a, fundamental way that we relate to each other, which is one of the reasons people are dissatisfied with politics.
Let's go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I agree with your analysis that the underlying structural problem is the two-party winner-take-all system. But I think in addition to that, you also have to include getting rid of the money factor. You need public funding. Because even if you have proportional representation in multiple political parties, the oligarchs, just like they do with our present duopoly, control. And if you look at politics, it's a propaganda matter. And it's a function of who controls the quantity, and the quantity is controlled by who has the money. And compounding this is the fact that the information that people get, in other words, I can destroy an issue just by not covering it or having a skewed panel looking at some particular aspect of it. The other compounding factor is the conglomeration of media in a conservative corporate frame.
John, I wish I had more time for you, but we only have a minute for Professor Wagner now to respond to that.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that call. I think, money in politics is something that most people find really distasteful. There's not a lot in the way of evidence that political scientists have uncovered that money affects how lawmakers do their job. But that's, usually a finding that most people are immediately skeptical of. But we haven't found a lot of relationship. And you can kind of think, elections periods are really short and money is not an issue in terms of giving to politicians, say, in England. But their politics are quite contentious as well. And, watching, the debates, in the English Parliament, are not love fests of policy debate either, and money's not the factor that it is here. And so, money's important, and it certainly may play a role in buying access to lawmakers. And that access, was part of the second point the caller was making, which is to say, I might be able to buy access to a lawmaker and get them to not do something. And that might be just as powerful as changing the law.
Well, we'll have to have you back to talk about how this is playing out during this election year.
I'm sure we'll have something to say.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.